now that her pa had been hiding her because he was scared of what people would do to her. But it still confused her because her pa loved her. So couldn't other people love her too? What difference did it make when you slept and when you hunted? It seemed like everyone must love the feeling of lying in the warm sunlight of a window, or seeing a bird fly across the sky, or taking a walk on a cool moonlit night when all the stars were overhead. She wasn't sure if most boys and girls her age could catch one rat or two with their bare hands, but she didn't think that it was too strange a thing either way. As another search party moved past her, Serafina watched them and shook her head. If Clara Brahms was alive and wanted to hide, there were plenty of places for her to do so. Adults, even 100 of them running around in a panic, didn't seem to grasp all that was possible in a place like Biltmore. There were thousands of places to hide. She hoped they would somehow find Clara, despite what she had seen happen the night before. But she didn't think they would. Clara Brahms was gone. "You're too loud and moving too fast," she thought as the searchers went by. "You're never going to find her that way. You've got to catch the rat." Her pa had told her to leave them to it, that it wasn't any of her business, that they weren't her kin. But who was he to say who was kin and who wasn't? He stole babies out of the woods. What if Clara was still alive and needed her help? How could she just sit there and watch? What if the man in the black cloak came again and took someone else? She resolved that she needed to find Braden Vanderbilt again and tell him what she'd seen. It wouldn't be right not to. She'd always dreamed of having a friend. But what kind of friend was she going to be to Clara Brahms if she didn't try to help her? When the corridor was clear, she crawled out of the chute and snuck away. Her plan was to creep upstairs, but when she passed the mossy stairway that led down to the lower levels of the basement, she wondered if there'd be any sign of what had happened the night before. The young master would be far more likely to believe her story if she could bring him some sort of evidence of what she'd seen. She slinked down the stairs, down and down again, into the damp darkness of the sub-basement, until she came to the slanted, brown-dripping corridor. She couldn't stop her breathing from getting heavier, but she kept going, telling herself that she'd be safe. She crept through the darkness until she came to the spot where she'd seen the man in the black cloak. There was no sign of Clara Brahms, but there were red drips on the wall. On the floor, she found a tiny shard of glass. "From the broken lantern," she thought. She searched the area, but found nothing else. On her way back, she followed the same series of corridors she had used to escape the demon, or whatever it was. She studied the areas where she had battled for her life. She spotted something lying at the base of the wall that at first glance looked like a dead, rotting rat. It had the size and color of one of the nasty vermin. But as she took a step closer, her nose wrinkled. It gave off a putrid, foul smell, but it wasn't a rat. She clenched her teeth and got down onto her hands and knees and examined it. It was a glove lying crumpled on the floor. Images of the black cloak swirling around her rose up in her mind, the cloak cutting her off from all she knew and loved. "It's just a glove, you silly fool," she thought, smiling at her scaredy-cat thoughts. But when she picked it up, her mouth curled in disgust. Inside the glove, there were bloody patches of skin. It was so disgusting, far worse than any rat carcass she'd ever found. But she forced herself to examine it more closely. The glove was made out of a fine, thin, black satin material. The flakes and patches of skin inside appeared as if they had sloughed off the hand that had last worn the glove. The skin had black spots and gray hairs. It was as if the owner of the glove hadn't just been old, but aging rapidly, almost disintegrating. Her muscles twitched as she remembered fighting for her life. She had bitten and clawed in a wild frenzy. The glove must have fallen from his belt or pocket, for she remembered that his hands had been bare and bloody when she fought him. Men's gloves were as common as top hats and canes, so it wasn't a very good clue. It didn't provide her evidence to show to the young master, but it did stiffen the idea that whoever or whatever the man in the black cloak was, there was something wrong with him. Anxious to get out of the damp and more determined than ever to find the young master, she scampered her way up to the main level of the basement. Many of the rooms on this level had windows at the tops of the walls. Outside, she could see servants and guests searching the gardens, the Ramble's Maze, and the many footpaths. She couldn't help but hope to see Braden Vanderbilt among them. She wondered if she could think of Braden as her friend now, or if she was fooling herself. The God's honest truth was that she didn't even know what a friend was, other than what she'd read in books. If you meet someone face to face and they don't hiss at you and bite you, does that mean you're friends? But when she thought about it a little more, she remembered that she did, in fact, nearly hiss at the young master when they first met, so that wasn't ideal. Maybe they weren't friends at all. Maybe he thought she was nothing but a lowly dirt scraper from the basement and she didn't warrant a second thought. She probably should have told him right off that she was the CRC. That would have been a lot more impressive. As it was, she just wasn't sure what sort of impression she'd made, except that she was dirty, rude, unkempt, and had bad hair. She darted up the stairs to the first floor. She took advantage of the chaos of the search to scurry unseen from one hiding spot to another. She moved silently, padding swiftly on soft feet. The adults spoke so loudly and made such a galumphing noise when they stomped all over the place that they were easy to avoid. She dashed over to the winter garden, where she hid beneath the fronds of the tropical plants. As Mrs. Vanderbilt and two servants hurried down the corridor, Serafina scooted into the billiard room and made a narrow escape. She thought that even her rodent enemies would have been impressed by her quickness of foot on that particular maneuver. Walled in rich oak paneling and appointed with soft leather chairs, the billiard room smelled of cigar smoke. Deep-hued oriental carpets covered the floor. Black wrought iron lamp fixtures hung down from the ceiling over the game tables. Animal heads and hunting trophies lined the walls. She liked those. The trophies on the walls reminded her of the rats she'd killed and laid at her paw's feet. So, she and the Vanderbilts had that much in common. On the other hand, she had stopped doing that when she realized that it was the catching she liked more than the killing. Just as she was about to leave the room, a footman came in with one of the maids. Serafina quickly dove beneath the billiard table.
"Maybe she's been giving us the slip at every turn, Miss Whitney,"
the footman said, leaning down to look under the billiard table, just as Serafina darted behind the sofa.
"She could be just about anywhere, Mr. Pratt,"
Miss Whitney agreed, looking behind the sofa just as Serafina hid in the green velvet curtains that adorn the windows.
Do you know if anyone has checked the pipe organ?
Mr. Pratt asked.
There's a secret room back there.
The girl is a pianist, so she might be curious about the organ.
Miss Whitney agreed. Taking a quick breath and using the curtain for cover, Serafina climbed up the window style lickety-split, then wedged herself into the uppermost corner of the window. She had just enough time to see that Mr. Pratt was wearing white gloves, a black tie, and a black-and-white footman's livery. But she took special notice of his black patent leather dress shoes.
"What do you mean, she's a pianist?"
Mr. Pratt asked.
"Tilly on the third floor told me the girl's some sort of musical prodigy, gives piano concerts all over the country,"
Miss Whitney said, as she ran her hands through the curtains where Serafina had just been hiding. Serafina held her breath and stayed very still. Miss Whitney was so close to her now that she could smell her sweet lavender and rose perfume. All Miss Whitney had to do was pull back the curtain and look up, and she'd see Serafina clinging there with a Cheshire smile. Despite her fear of being seen, Serafina couldn't resist noticing the details of the maid's outfit. She loved the pretty pink uniform with its white collar and cuffs, which the maids wore in the morning before changing into their more formal black and white uniforms in the afternoon.
"Come on, there's no one in here," Mr. Pratt said. "We'll check the pipe organ."
Serafina breathed a sigh of relief as Miss Whitney walked to the other side of the room. Mr. Pratt pushed the oak-paneled wall just to the right of the fireplace.
"Oh, my!"
Miss Whitney said in surprise, laughing nervously as a concealed door opened up.
"I've cleaned this room countless times, and I never knew that was there. You're always so clever, Mr. Pratt."
Serafina rolled her eyes at Miss Whitney's silliness. The maid was obviously besotted with this know-it-all footman. Serafina liked Miss Whitney, but she could sure use some help learning how to sniff out a rat. And that was exactly what Serafina thought about shiny shoes Mr. Pratt. Mr. Pratt laughed, clearly pleased with Miss Whitney's reaction to his little trick.
"How do you know about all these secret things?"
Miss Whitney asked him.
"Do you skulk through the rooms at night when everyone else is sleeping?"
"Oh, I'm full of surprises, Miss Whitney, and not just about a little girl in a yellow dress. You wait and see," he said. "Come on."
Yellow dress? How did he know what Clara was wearing when she disappeared? There was something about this footman that Serafina didn't like. He was too slick, too flirty, too tricky in his hoity-toity black livery. And she didn't trust him any more than she trusted a rat in the pastry kitchen.
"I wouldn't go in there if I were you,"
she wanted to shout to Miss Whitney as they passed through the concealed door. But instead, she listened to the rat's footsteps. They were similar to the footsteps she'd heard in the basement the night before. But he and Miss Whitney disappeared into the wall too quickly for her to be sure one way or the other. As soon as they were gone, she climbed down and checked the area to the right of the fireplace to make sure she'd be able to find the concealed door if she ever needed it. A concealed door could be a very useful thing to a girl of her particular occupation. Measuring 3 oak panels tall and 2 oak panels wide, the door was disguised to look exactly like the wall. There was even a framed picture hanging there, a weirdly realistic tintype of a white-haired old man that she guessed was probably Mr. Vanderbilt's long-dead grandfather, Cornelius Vanderbilt. It pained her to think that not only did she not have a grandpa to tell her stories about the old times, she barely even had a pa anymore. He was just someone who found her in a bloody heap and decided to steal goat's milk to keep her alive in his toolbox. He could be anybody. And she was still mightily perturbed at him for not coming straight with her sooner. Below the hunting trophies that loomed above, the wall was covered with portraits of Vanderbilts. Mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, brothers and sisters and cousins. She found herself instinctively searching the faces to see if any of them resembled her. Was Clara Brahms alive someplace, wondering if her mother had forgotten her, just as Serafina often wondered about her own? But the difference was that Mrs. Brahms hadn't forgotten her daughter, would never leave her behind. Clara Brahms's mother was still looking for her. Serafina stepped closer to the wall of pictures. The last picture was another depiction of old Cornelius, the patriarch of the grand Vanderbilt family, walking proudly beside one of his iron steam trains, the blur of his motion giving him a ghost-like quality. It put shivers down her spine just looking at it. But the picture had gone a bit catawampus when Mr. Pratt and Miss Whitney went through, so she straightened it out. When she touched the door, it glided open on smooth, well-oiled hinges. She took a deep breath, then slipped through. To her surprise, the secret door led to the smoking room. From there, she found a similar passage into the gun room, with its racks of rifles and shotguns protected by panes of glass. Seeing her reflection in the glass, she spit on the back of her hand and wiped her face until she got a few of the larger smudges off her cheeks and chin. Then she smoothed her long brown streaked hair back behind her ears in a few quick movements. She stood there and just stared at herself, wondering if her mama saw her, would she recognize her? Would she hug her and kiss her? Or would she look the other way and just keep walking? When strangers saw her, what did they think? What did they see? A girl or a creature? As a group of estate guests walked past the room, she heard them talking in hushed voices that perked up her ears. "I'm telling you, it's true," a young man whispered. "I heard about it too," whispered another. "My grandmama told me that there's an old cemetery out there with hundreds of gravestones, but the bodies are missing." "I heard there's an old village," said a third voice. "It's all overgrown and taken back by the forest, like everyone who lived there abandoned their houses." Serafina had heard the tall tales passed around among the kitchen folk at night, but she'd never been too sure whether she was supposed to believe them or not. Every place she went in the house that day, she overheard conversations. Gentlemen discussing whether detectives should be called in to investigate the missing child, servants trading stories about suspicious guests, and parents arguing about the best way to protect their sons and daughters from getting lost in the giant house without being rude to the Vanderbilts. And now they were talking about the old cemetery in the woods. She kept thinking about the man in the black cloak. If he was one of these people, he could be lurking in any corridor or room. How do you tell a friend from an enemy just by looking at him? It seemed like the farther she went, the more questions she had. The only thing certain so far was that the search continued, and they still hadn't found Clara Brahms, either alive or dead. Then she had an idea. If the man in the black cloak was some sort of wraith that drifted out of the forest at night, Or if he conjured himself out of the ether in the basement, then she probably wouldn't find very much evidence of him in the upper floors of the house. But if the man in the black cloak was at least partially immortal and resided at Biltmore, then he'd have to stash his cloak someplace when he wasn't wearing it. If she could find the cloak, then maybe she could find the man. The closets and storerooms throughout the house were some of her favorite hiding spots, so she knew them well. When ladies and gentlemen came to Biltmore, they usually exited from their carriages at the front door, but in bad weather, they used the covered porte-cochere at the north end of the house, near the stables. Always just out of sight, darting and dodging, creeping and crawling, she made her way there. The coat room was dark and cramped, which suited her just fine. She loved closets. As she pushed her way through the thick forest of coats, cloaks, stoles, and capes, she searched the hangers one by one, looking for a long black satin cloak. When she reached the back wall of the coat room without finding it, she couldn't help but feel a pang of disappointment. As she crept out of the coat room, she realized that she'd have to go to Braden without any proof. But the truth was that she hadn't been able to find him, either.
"You've got to think, girl," she heard her pa telling her in the tone he used when she couldn't reckon one of her lessons. "Use what you know and think it through."
An idea came to her. Knowing what she did about Braden Vanderbilt, he'd either be with his dog or his horse or both. He loved horses. It would be the first thing he thought of. He'd go to the stables to help the stableman look for Clara Brahms there, or maybe he'd search the grounds on horseback. Either way, the stables seemed like the place to go. The most direct path was through the porte cochere. There were quite a few people coming and going through this busy area, but she hoped that if anyone spotted her, they'd assume she was a scullery maid or a kindling girl going about her chores. She took a deep breath and ran down the steps toward the archway that led to the stables. She moved fast. She thought she was going to make it. But just as she looked behind her to make sure no one was following her, she collided with a great smash into a large man in front of her. It knocked the wind out of her and nearly knocked her off her feet. But the man grabbed her by the shoulders and held her up with a brutal grip. Her captor wore a full-length black rain cloak, even though it wasn't raining. He had a peculiar pointed beard, crooked teeth, and an ugly, pockmarked face. She hadn't seen the face of the man in the black cloak, but this is what she'd imagined he'd look like.
"What you looking at?" he demanded. "Who is you, anyway?"
"I ain't nobody," she spat defiantly, trying desperately to tear herself free and run. But the man's hands clamped her so tight that she couldn't escape. Now it was her turn to be the biting rat with its neck squeezed between finger and thumb. She noticed that he was standing in front of the open door of an awaiting carriage.
"You the new pig girl?" the man demanded. "What are you doing up here?"
He tightened his grip so viciously on her arms that she let out a squeal of pain.
"I said, what's your name, you little scamp?"
"None of your business," she said as she kicked and fought any way she could. The man had a terrible smell, like he needed a bath really, really bad, and his breath stank with the huge wad of putrefied chewing tobacco that bulged in his cheek.
"Tell me your name, or I'm gonna shake you,"
the man said, even as he shook her. He shook her so violently that she couldn't catch her breath or get her feet on the ground. He just kept shaking her. "Mr. Crankshod," a firm, authoritative voice said from behind her. It wasn't just a name. It was a command. Startled, The ugly man stopped shaking her. He set her on her feet and began to smooth her hair, pretending that he had actually been taking care of her all along. Gasping for breath, she turned to look at who had spoken. There stood Braden Vanderbilt at the top of the steps. Chapter 6. Serafina's heart sprang. Despite the terrible situation he'd caught her in and the angry expression on his face, she was glad to see Braden. The crab, crankety Mr. Crankshod, however, was far less pleased.
"Young Master Vanderbilt,"
he grumbled in surprise as he bowed, wiped the tobacco spittle from his lip, and stood at attention.
"I beg your pardon, sir. I didn't see you there. Your coach is ready, sir."
Braden looked at them both without speaking. Clearly, he wasn't pleased by what he'd just seen. The boy's Doberman appeared ready to attack whichever of them his master told him to, and Serafina hoped that it was going to be the sputum-faced Mr. Crankshod rather than her. Braden stared at Mr. Crankshod, then slowly moved his eyes to her. Her mind whirled with potential cover stories. He had stopped the mountainous brute from shaking the living daylights out of her. But what could she say to explain her presence here?
"I'm the new shoeshine girl," she said, stepping forward. "Your aunt asked me to make sure your boots were well shined for your trip, sir. Spit and polished good, sir. That's what she said, all right. Spit and polished good."
"No, no, no,"
Mr. Crankshod shouted, knowing it was a ruse.
"What's this now, you little beggar? You ain't no shoeshine girl. Who is ye? Where'd you come from?"
But a smile of delicious conspiracy formed at the corner of Braden's mouth.
"Ah, yes. Aunt Edith did mention something about getting my boots shined. I had quite forgotten," he said, exaggerating the aristocratic air in his voice.
Then he looked at her sharply, and his eyebrows furrowed into a frown.
"I'm on my way to the Vances, and I'm running late. I don't have time to wait on you, so you'll just have to come with me and do it in the carriage on the way."
Serafina felt the blood rush to her face. Was he serious? She couldn't go in a carriage with him. Her pa would kill her. And what was she going to do while cooped up in there anyway, getting dragged around in a box by a bunch of four-legged black hoof stompers?
"Well, come along. Let's be quick about it," Braden said,
his voice filled with the impatience of a lordly gentleman as he gestured toward the carriage door. She had never been in a carriage in her life. She didn't even know how to get in one, or what to do once she did. The ill-tempered, rat-faced Mr. Crankshod had no choice but to obey the young master's commands. He shoved Serafina toward the door, and she suddenly found herself in the dimly lit interior of the Vanderbilt carriage. As she crouched uncertainly on the floor, she could not help but marvel at the carriage's luxuriously appointed finery with its hand-carved woodwork, brass fixtures, beveled glass windows, and plush, paisley-tufted seats. Braden followed her in with the grace of familiarity and took a seat. Gideon sat on the floor, eyeing her with fanged intent. "Mind your own business, dog," she thought as she stared back at him. Mr. Crankshod shut the carriage door and climbed up onto the driver's bench with the other coachman.
"Oh, great! Ratface is driving us," Serafina thought. She had no idea how long a trip this would be or how she could send word back to her pa.
He'd ordered her to hide in the basement, not get kidnapped by the young master and his stink-breathed henchmen. But at least she'd finally be able to talk to Braden alone about what she saw the night before. The carriage seat looked too clean for her to sit on with her basement clothing, and she was supposed to be cleaning the young master's boots. So she knelt on the floor of the carriage and wondered how she was going to pretend to clean his boots when she didn't have any brushes or polish. Spit and polish was one thing, but just spit was another.
"You don't really have to clean my boots," Braden said softly. "I was just going along with your story."
Just as Serafina looked up at him and their eyes were about to meet, the horses pulled and the carriage jounced forward. In a moment as unusual as it was mortifying, she actually lost her balance.
"I'm sorry,"
she mumbled as she fell against Braden's legs and then quickly straightened herself up. She glanced at the seat that she suspected she was supposed to be sitting on, but the dog stared at her with his steely eyes. When she moved toward the seat, the dog growled, low and menacing, baring his teeth as if to say, "If I can't sit on the seat, then neither can you."
"No, Gideon,"
Braden chastised him. She couldn't decide if the young master had spoken the command because he wanted to protect her or if he just didn't want to get the inside of his carriage bloody. In any case, Gideon's ears crumpled and his head lowered under the force of his master's reprimand. Seeing her chance, she slipped onto the seat opposite Braden and as far away from the dog as possible. As Gideon continued staring at her, she felt an overwhelming desire to hiss at him and make him back off. But she didn't think that would go over too well with the young master, so she held back the urge. She had never liked dogs, and dogs had never liked her. Whenever they saw her, they barked. One time, she had to scurry up a tree to get away from a crazed foxhound, and her paw had to use a ladder to retrieve her. When the carriage rumbled into a turn, Serafina looked out the window and saw the grand facade of the house. Biltmore Estate rose 4 stories high with its ornately carved gray stone walls. Gargoyles and ancient warriors adorned its dark copper edges. Chimneys, turrets, and towers formed the spires of its almost Gothic presence. 2 giant statues of lions guarded the massive oak doors at the entrance, as if warding off evil spirits. She had marveled at those statues many times on her midnight prowls. She had always loved them. She imagined that those great cats were Biltmore's protectors, its guardians, and she could think of no more important job. In the golden light of the setting sun, the mansion really could be quite startlingly lovely. But as the sun withdrew its brightness behind the surrounding mountains, it cast ominous shadows across the estate, which reminded her of griffins, chimeras, and other twisted creatures of the night that were half one thing and half another. The thought of it gave her a shudder. In one moment, the estate was the most beautiful home you had ever seen. But in the next, it was a dark and foreboding haunted castle. "Lie down and be good," Braden said. She looked at him in surprise and then realized that he was talking to the dog, not to her. Gideon complied with his master's request and lay down at his feet. The dog seemed a little more relaxed now. But when he looked at Serafina, his expression seemed to say, "Just because I'm lying down, don't think for a second that if you do something to my master, I can't still kill you." She smiled to herself. She couldn't help it. She was beginning to like this dog. She could understand him, his fierceness and his loyalty. She admired that. As she tried to get used to the rumbling motion of the moving carriage, she noticed that Braden was studying her.
I've been looking for you, he said. She stole a quick glance at him and then looked away. When she looked into his eyes, it felt like he could tell what she was thinking. It was unnerving. She tried to say something, but when she opened her mouth, she could barely breathe. Of course, she'd snuck around enough over the years to overhear people of all walks of life speaking to one another, so theoretically she knew how it was done. So many guests and servants had passed through Biltmore over the years that she could take on a rich lady's air or a mountain woman's twang or even a New York accent. But for some reason, she struggled mightily to find the right words, any words, to say to the young master.
I'm sorry about all this, she said finally.
The annoying constriction in her chest seemed to strangle her words as she spoke them. She wasn't sure if she sounded anything like a halfway normal person or not.
I mean, I'm sorry about being dumped into your carriage like luggage that wouldn't fit on the roof. And I don't know why your dog doesn't like me.
Braden looked at Gideon and then back at her. He normally likes people, especially girls. It's strange.
There are plenty of strange things happening today, she said,
her chest loosening up a bit as she began to realize that Braden was going to actually talk to her.
You think so too? He said, leaning toward her.
He wasn't anything like what she imagined the young master of the Vanderbilt mansion would be, especially as good-looking and well-educated as he was. She had expected him to be snobbish, bossy, and aloof, but he was none of these things.
I don't think Clara Brahms is hiding, he said in a conspiratorial tone. Do you?
No,
she said, raising her eyes and looking at him.
I definitely don't.
She wanted to pour it all out and tell him everything she knew. That had been her plan all along. But her pa's words kept going through her mind.
They ain't our kind of folk, Sarah.
Whatever he was, Braden seemed to be a good person. As he was talking to her, he didn't judge her or discount her. If anything, he actually seemed to like her. Or maybe he was just fascinated by her in the same way he would be by a weird species of insect he'd never seen before. But either way, he kept talking.
She's not the first one, you know, he whispered.
What do you mean?
She said, drawing closer to him.
2 weeks ago, a 15-year-old girl named Anastasia Rostanova went out for a walk in the evening in the Rambles, and she didn't come back.
Really?
She asked, hanging on his every word. She had thought she had something to tell him, but it turned out that he had just as much to tell her. A boy who whispered about kidnappings and skullduggery was the kind of boy she could learn to like. She knew the Rambles well, but she also knew that the shrubbery maze of crisscrossing paths caused many people great confusion.
Everyone said Anastasia must have wandered into the forest and gotten lost, he continued, or that she ran away from home. But I know they're wrong.
How do you know?
She asked, keen to hear the details.
The next morning, I found her little white dog wandering around the paths of the Rambles. The poor dog was frantic, desperately searching for her.
Braden looked at Gideon.
I didn't know Anastasia well. She'd only been visiting with her father for a couple of days when she disappeared. But I don't think she would have run away and left her dog behind.
Serafina thought that sounded about right.
Braden seemed as loyal to Gideon as Gideon was to him. They were friends, and she liked that. Then she thought about that poor girl and what might have happened to her. Anastasia Rostanova, she repeated the funny-sounding name.
She's the daughter of Mr. Rostanov, the Russian ambassador, Braden explained. She told me that Russian girls always put an A on the end of their last name.
What did she look like? She asked, wanting to make sure she hadn't gotten her kidnapped rich girls mixed up.
She's tall and pretty, and she has long, curly black hair, and she wears elaborate red dresses that look really hard to walk in.
Do you think she vanished like Clara Brahms? Serafina asked. Before he could answer, something caught her eye through the carriage windows. There were trees on either side of the carriage. They were traveling down a narrow dirt road that wound through a thick and darkened forest. The very forest that her pa had warned her to never enter. And the very forest where she had been born. She couldn't help but feel a pang of trepidation.
Where are we going exactly?
My aunt and uncle are worried about me, so they're sending me to the Vances in Asheville for the night to keep me out of harm's way. They ordered Crankshaw to guard me.
That wasn't very smart, she said before she could help herself. It wasn't a very polite thing to say, but for some reason, she was having a dickens of a time not telling Braden the truth.
I've always detested that man, Braden agreed. But my uncle depends on him.
As she looked out the window at the forest, she could no longer see the horizon or the sun. All she could see was the thick density of the forest's huge old trees, black and decrepit, which grew so closely together that she could barely tell one from the other. It seemed a dark and foreboding place for anyone to even visit, let alone live. But there was something that excited her about it, too. But then, she felt a sinking sensation in her stomach. Somewhere, miles behind them, was Biltmore. Her pa would be wondering why she wasn't showing up for dinner.
No chicken or grits tonight, Pa. I'm sorry, she thought. Try not to worry about me.
A day ago, she had been leading a perfectly normal life catching rats in the basement, and now everything had turned so bizarre. Pulling her gaze away from the forest, she finally turned to Braden, swallowed hard, and began to say what she'd come for.
There is something I need to tell.
How come I've never seen you before? He interrupted.
What?
She asked, taken aback.
Where do you come from?
Yeah, good question,
she said before she could stop herself, imagining the bloody pile of dead creatures her pa had plucked her from.
I'm serious, he said, staring at her. Why haven't I seen you before?
Maybe you haven't been looking in the right places.
She shot back at him, feeling cornered. But when she saw his eyes, she realized that he wasn't going to give up. Her temples began to pound, and she couldn't think straight. Why was he asking all these infernal questions?
Well, where do you come from? She asked, trying to throw him off the trail.
You know I live at Biltmore, he said gently. I'm asking about you.
I, she stammered, staring at her lap. Maybe you met me before and just forgot, she said.
I would have remembered you, he said quietly.
Well, maybe I'm just visiting for the weekend, she said weakly, looking at the floor.
He wasn't buying any of it.
"Please tell me where you live, Serafina," he said firmly.
It surprised her when he said her name like that. It had tremendous power over her, like she had no choice but to look up at him and meet his gaze, which turned out to be a serious mistake. He was looking at her so intently that it felt as if he were casting a spell of truth on her.
"I live in your basement," she said, and was immediately shocked that she'd actually uttered it out loud.
He had powers over her that she did not understand. He stared at her as her words hung in the air. She could see the confusion in his face and sense the questions forming in his mind. She had no idea why she said it. It had just come flying out of her mouth. But she'd done it. She'd said it out loud, straight to his face.
"Please forgive me, Pa."
She'd wrecked everything. She'd ruined their lives. Now her Pa would be fired. They'd be kicked out of Biltmore. They'd be forced to wander the streets of Asheville, begging for scraps of food. No one would hire a man who'd lied to his employer, holed up in his basement, and stolen food from him for his eight-toed daughter. No one. She looked at Braden.
"Please don't tell anyone," she said quietly.
But she knew there were no claws in that paw. Nothing at all to protect her. If he wanted to, he could tell anyone. Mr. Crankshod, Mr. Bozeman, even Mr. and Mrs. Vanderbilt. And then the life she and her pa had made together at Biltmore would be over. They might even go to prison for stealing food all those years. Just as Braden was about to speak, the horses screamed, and the carriage slammed to a halt. She was hurled across the open space and crashed into him. Gideon leapt to his feet and began to bark wildly. "Something has happened," Braden said fiercely as he quickly untangled himself from her and opened the carriage door. It was pitch dark outside. She tried to listen for what was out there, but her heart pounded so loudly that she couldn't hear a thing. She tried to calm herself down and really listen. But the forest was too quiet. There were no owls, no frogs, no insects, no birds. None of the normal night sounds she was used to hearing. Just silence. It was like every living creature in the forest was hiding for its dear life, or already dead.
"Mr. Crankshod?"
Braden asked uncertainly into the darkness. No answer came. The hairs on the back of Serafina's neck stood on end. Braden stepped partway out of the carriage and looked up at the driver's bench at the front.
"There's no one there," he said in astonishment. "They're both gone."
The four horses were still in the harnesses, but the carriage had stopped dead in the road, right in the middle of the forest. Chapter 7 Serafina climbed slowly out of the carriage and stood at Braden's side. The forest surrounded them, black and impenetrable. The craggy-barked trees packed densely together. Her legs jittered beneath her, filled with nervous impulse. She tried to steady her breathing. Her whole body wanted to move, but she forced herself to stay with Braden and Gideon. She watched and listened to the unnaturally quiet forest, extending her senses out into the void. She couldn't hear a single toad or whippoorwill. But it felt like there was something out there, something big but extremely quiet. She didn't even know how that was possible. Gideon stood beside her on full alert, staring into the trees. Whatever it was, he sensed it too. Raiden looked warily into the darkness that surrounded them and walked forward a few feet in the direction the carriage was facing.
"I wish I had a lantern," he said. "I can't see anything at all."
The horses fidgeted in their harnesses, their hooves shifting uneasily in the gravel.
"When they're scared, they move their feet,"
Braden said sympathetically.
"They have no claws, no sharp teeth, no weapons. Their speed is their main defense."
She marveled at how Braden didn't just see the horses, but understood how they thought. When a breeze passed through the woods and rattled the branches of the trees, the horses spooked. All four of them pulled and tugged against their harnesses. It was like they were being attacked by some invisible predator. Squealing, the front two horses reared up on their hind legs and struck the air with their hooves. As Seraphina shrank back from the danger in frightened dismay, Braden rushed forward and put himself between her and the horses. Standing in front of them, he raised his open hands to calm them. They towered above him, their eyes white with fear, their heads thrashing and their hooves flying. She was sure they were going to kick him in the head, or slam him with a shoulder, or trample him to death. But he stood with his hands raised, speaking to them in soft, gentle tones.
"It's all right. We're all here," he said to them. "We're all together."
To her astonishment, the horses were calmed by his presence and his words. He touched their shoulders with his outstretched hands and seemed to bring the rearing horses back to the ground. Then he held the head of the lead horse in his hands and pressed his forehead to the horse's forehead so that they were looking at each other eye to eye, and he spoke to the horses in quiet, reassuring tones.
"We're in this together, my friend. We're going to be all right. There's no need to run, no need to fight."
The lead horse breathed heavily through its nose as it listened to Braden's words, then settled and became still. The other horses quieted as well, reassured by the young master.
How did you...
she stammered.
"These horses and I have been friends for a long time," he replied,
but said nothing more. Still astounded by what he'd done, she looked around at their surroundings.
"What do you think frightened them?"
"I don't know," he said. "I've never seen them so scared."
Braden turned and looked down the road ahead of them. He squinted into the darkness, and then he pointed.
"What is that up there?"
he asked.
"I can't make it out. Does the road turn?"
She looked in the direction he pointed. It wasn't a turn in the road. A huge tree with thick, gnarly branches and a scattering of blood-red leaves lay across the road, completely blocking their path. Suddenly, Mr. Crankshod emerged out of the darkness, trudging his way back to the carriage.
"We're gonna need the axe,"
he grumbled angrily. Seraphina and Braden looked at each other in surprise, then looked back at Mr. Crankshod.
"Where have you been?"
Braden asked.
"We're gonna need the axe,"
Mr. Crankshod said again, ignoring the question.
"I'll get it, sir,"
the assistant coachman said as he came running up from behind Mr. Crankshod. She hadn't noticed him before, but the assistant coachman was just a skinny boy with a mop of curly hair. He stood no taller than the shoulder of the lead horse, and had thin arms and legs, bony knees and elbows, and a coltish skittishness about him. He wore a coachman's jacket, but it was several sizes too big in the shoulders, and the sleeves were too long. His black coachman's top hat seemed ridiculously tall on his little head. The boy couldn't have been older than 10. He ran to the rear of the carriage, opened the wooden storage box, and grabbed the axe, which looked huge in his hands.
"That's Nolan," Braden said, leaning toward her. "He's actually one of the best carriage drivers we have, and he takes very good care of the horses."
"Give it to me,"
Mr. Crankshod barked as he grabbed the axe out of Nolan's hands and stomped over to the fallen tree.
"I can help too, sir. I can,"
Nolan said, tagging along behind him with a small hatchet.
"No, you can't. Just stay out of the way, boy,"
Mr. Crankshod shouted. He seemed irritated that Nolan was even there. Mr. Crankshod heaved the axe behind him in a great sweeping swing and slammed the blade into the center of the trunk. The leaves of the tree shuddered with the force of the blow, but it hardly made any dent at all in the thick bark. He swung the axe again and again, and finally cut through the bark. The wood chips began to fly. Serafina couldn't help but notice the brute strength of the man, but it was hard for her to tell if this was the same type of strength the man in the black cloak had possessed.
"At this rate, we're going to be here all night,"
Mr. Crankshod complained, and just kept chopping.
"I'm sure I can help, sir. I'm sure I can,"
Nolan said enthusiastically, standing by with his hatchet ready.
"I'm sure you can. Now just get back and stay out of the way,"
Mr. Crankshod shouted.
"You're no use to anybody here, boy."
As the grumpy Mr. Crankshod made war on the tree, Serafina noticed Braden looking around them, trying to figure out if there was a way to navigate the carriage around the obstacle. But the trees of this wicked forest grew so closely together that a man could barely get through them, let alone a carriage with a team of horses.
"Where are we?" Serafina asked.
"I think we're about 11 or 12 miles from the estate. A place called Darden Forest," Braden said. "There used to be an old town nearby."
"Haven't been any people living in that village for years,"
Mr. Crankshod grumbled as he chopped at the tree.
"Nothing but ghosts and demons left in these woods now."
Serafina scanned the forest, filled with a sense of foreboding. It felt like they were being watched, but she couldn't figure out why she couldn't detect who or what was out there. Her ears twitched with nervousness. The trees slowly swayed back and forth in the wind. They were covered in strange gray lichen and strung with grayish-white moss, which hung down like the thin hair of an old dead woman. The branches buffeted and creaked, as if anxious in their plight. It appeared that many of the trees were dying. She walked along the length of the fallen tree. She thought it was peculiar that the tree still held its red leaves this late in the year, but it was what she saw at the base of the trunk that truly disturbed her.
"Come look at this, Braden," she said.
"What have you found?"
he asked as he came up behind her.
"I thought the tree must be an old snag that had rotted and fallen over in the last storm. But take a look."
The stump of the tree didn't appear rotted, and it didn't have the fibrous appearance of a trunk that had been snapped by high winds. It was difficult to tell, but it almost appeared as if it had been gnawed by giant teeth or cut down with an axe.
"Look at the angle here,"
Braden said, gesturing at the side of the stump in anger and confusion.
"Someone purposely felled this tree so that it would block the road."
Gideon barked and made Serafina jump a mile. As the dog kept barking, Braden knelt at his side and put his hands on the dog's back.
"What's wrong, boy? What do you smell?"
"If it's all right with you," Mr. Crankshod said gruffly, "we're not going to wait around to find out."
Spooked by the dog, and apparently convinced that he'd cut through enough of the trunk, Mr. Crankshaw dropped the axe, braced his heavy boots against the earth, and grabbed hold of the branches. He tried to drag the